This podcast is brought to you with limited interruption by Rudy Luther Toyota. Whether looking for an exciting brand new Toyota, a certified pre-owned vehicle, or getting quality routine maintenance and service for your vehicle, Rudy Luther Toyota is the place to go. Rudy Luther Toyota, the southeast corner of 394 and 169 in Golden Valley. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota, the Matt McNeil Show for your Thursday. We are jam-packed, Patrick. Jam-packed. Only a quick note that, wow, if only the Wild played against St. Louis like that all the time. You watch any of that game last night?
Watch the whole thing.
I
did.
God, what time did it get over? Like midnight?
11:30, 11:45. I'm up that late anyway, so no big deal.
I have kids. I go to sleep at 8:30 still. So many people wanted Erickson Ek to get the hat trick. He was so close. He was offsides. That was a legit call. But, Kaprizov getting that. I hope they use this as a way to kind of propel themselves, but they still have, an uphill climb because that's only the first time all season long they've beaten the Blues, and they got to go now on the road, and they've got to win one in St. Louis.
Yeah, but I was kind of thinking they're going to have to win in St. Louis at some point if they want to win this series. Now, the thing about last night was the Wild got ahead 4-0, but, you know, after watching the Timberwolves the last couple weeks and then the Blues get it to 4-2,
yeah,
and then
they get a
power play, and I'm kind of starting to sit there like, I don't like where this is going, but, you know, everything turned out okay, so that's good.
Kaprizov became Kaprizov, let's just be honest. I mean, that kid is as advertised. He is a pretty amazing hockey player. All right, so here you go. Ready to go, just ready to, you can just sleep in there. Just get these guys on the phone. Dr. Joe in about 5 minutes, okay? Schechter at 4:30 obviously wants to chime in on the Alito ruling, as well as also J.D. Vance. Of course, he's in Ohio. He'll give his thoughts on that. He has an article in the New Republic. We'll talk about that. Coming up here at the top of the hour, in the 5 o'clock hour, Alicia Donahue, Senate District 54. Now, that's going to be an interesting race because, if I'm not mistaken, that's one of the seats that the Mortensen crew has targeted to put in one of these extreme far right candidates. And I believe that she won the initial endorsement on this. They haven't gone to the convention, but I think that the far right Republican candidates got that. And Prior Lake is not that far right. We'll talk to Alicia Donahue coming up here in the 5 o'clock hour, plus more there. If you go right ahead, go on and pull up Dr. Joe, get him on the line here. We'll talk to him in just a second. And as a matter of fact, I might as well start off with that. It's the Minnesota coronavirus update for today. Now, first of all, if you didn't hear the news, as we've talked about it, there's a lot of people that are starting to get more COVID. It's starting to become more prevalent. Rocco Baldelli, the manager of the Twins. Baldelli was the sideline with a positive COVID-19 test. Bench coach Jace Tingler. The Tingler is here. Who was with the Padres manager for most of the last season, will run the team tonight. Watch out for the Tingler, Baltimore. Oh, the Tingler's coming. But yet just the latest person that you're hearing getting caught up in the COVID. Thursday's COVID-19 update from the Minnesota Department of Health includes 2,288 newly reported cases. That's in one day. 6 newly reported deaths. Once again, that number seems to be going back up again. State's COVID-19 death toll now is 12,521. Today's update includes case data that was reported the 24-hour period ending at 4 a.m. on Wednesday. Through May 4th, the number of people with COVID-19 hospitalized in Minnesota was 298. That's up from 286 reported on May 3rd. Of those hospitalized, 26 people in intensive care, up from 22. 272 non-ICU care, that's up from 264. As of May 3rd, the state reported that 3,908,208 people have received at least one dose of the COVID-19 vaccine. 3,701,878 people have completed the vaccine series. There are 2,552,531 Minnesotans who are up to date with their vaccine shots, which includes boosters. Total number of cases in the state of Minnesota, 1,461,622. It is, I'm very grateful he joins us, Dr. Joe Eastman. He is an expert in mathematics, and he does research on COVID. He's part of the modeling team for the University of Texas right now. He's also worked overtime for NASA, for the Colorado State University, as well as the LTER. He's kind enough to join us today to talk about the latest number with COVID. Hey, Dr. Joe.
Hey, Matt. Thanks for having me on.
My pleasure. Can I say this? Where are we at right now? Because a part of me says, okay, it definitely seems like we're getting worse. It's not in the leaps and bounds it was under either Delta or Omicron, but we definitely seem to be getting worse. But yet it doesn't seem to be reflecting in the hospital numbers here. So where are we at right now with this BA2 variant?
All right. Well, you've asked kind of the million-dollar question right now.
Yeah.
What's going on is there's several factors that we're seeing. One is the decline in testing. And I know doctor friends of mine that they don't even know where to report their at-home tests. This thing is such a mess right now. The other thing that's going on is this bugger is highly asymptomatic. There's so many people out there that have it but don't realize it. And, of course, that's not going to get reported. And then you compound that with the lack of testing we should have. And it's out there. We're just not seeing it in the numbers that you report daily and inform us about. So that's kind of what's going on right now. Until we get that straightened out, we're not going to know where we're really at until we do. So
let's talk about because you're right. I mean, it's, and I've noticed it too. There's even the report I am able to pull up from Bring Me the News seems to be getting lighter and lighter on information almost every day. There is, you know, clearly there seems to have been a need to continue the testing but it seems like just once Omicron got over, even the federal government, who had been doing what I thought was their due diligence, kind of just got to the point. I was like, all right, we're good enough. We're done. And I am concerned. I am scared. I am bothered by the lackadaisical nature of this, because, you know, part of me looks at this and says, you know, clearly this you know, right now, these variants we're seeing right now are not necessarily really bad, but all we are is one horrific variant away from, you know, can we even pull back up the reporting system that we used to have? Or has been dismantled so much at this point that it would be next to impossible to get back up on our pandemic footing?
You've asked an excellent question. I just sat in on a seminar yesterday, and the project is doing precisely what you're talking about. They're trying to centralize all this data into one spot and keep it going so a scientist can easily download it, has wastewater testing, all these different things in there. But all of a sudden, their funding is drying up. And they're kind of at a midpoint where we're going to see fruition from this. But without any money to fund them, they're like, we're not sure how to proceed next. So, yes, we could easily get this thing going again with the adequate money to fund it. And the public outcry, which doesn't seem to be there. You notice you haven't seen much of Dr. Fauci lately, have you?
No. I mean, yeah, anyone from the CDC or really any from the administration, they really have just, this issue has seemed to disappear for them.
Yeah, it really has. And, you know, they kind of said, well, we're going into the epidemic stage now. And, you know, I'm sorry, but I don't remember influenza having all these different long-term health risks that COVID presents. Mm-hmm. You know, it's so far more dangerous. And to say it's over and then just kind of drop the ball is just it's unconscionable.
Well, and if I could make the point, in 2020, when Trump was in office, you know, there was a lot of things, and some of these things were not necessarily Trump's fault. We had a medical industry that had been more consumed with cost cutting than actually making sure, especially rural America, had the proper medical care in place to be able to sustain a large problem of this nature. We just didn't have that. We didn't have the infrastructure. We did not have the manpower. We did not have this ready for a pandemic, nor in the supplementary industries, the reporting industry, the vaccine industry. All this stuff have to be ramped up. I think Joe Biden did a fantastic job in the first 3 months of last year of his term, basically taking a non-existent system and creating one. We did very well, I think, through last year as far as numbers and vaccines and informational campaigns and doing this sort of thing. But the problem is we are a capitalist society. That's part of the problem that we had when this whole started. We are not a society that's built on the betterment of our fellow man. We are a society that's built on the buck, the dollar. That's what it is. And so it took us a while to get there. And as I look at what's going on right now, it's like, okay, did we not learn a damn thing from this? That we probably need to have at least a basic outline and infrastructure, a scaffolding in place that we can have that in case this starts rising back up again, we can get back at it quickly. But it seems like, you know, everyone's like, all right, go back to your regular jobs. We're done here. And it that is terrifying to me.
You and me both. The pieces are there. We can reassemble them a lot quicker than we originally put them together. So I think we have that on our side. But like you say, in a capitalist society, is there that willingness to push back on this and say, you know, well, if there's nobody to buy your stuff, what good is capitalism?
You would think that would have crossed someone's mind. Wait a minute here. Everyone's sick or dying. Well, that's not going to sell as many hamburgers, is it? No, it's not. I mean, it's those basic things. But I think it is, you know, we learned we need to have a basic scaffolding in place. And I do think that there is some there, but it is really remarkable as this, you know, current BA2 surge is going on. The BA2A1, A2B, whatever it is, the next one coming in. You know, as these are coming through, I'm sure we probably could ramp up a lot faster than we did in 2020. It just is, we're not done with this yet. We are not even close. We had 6 people die yesterday in the state of Minnesota alone. 6 die yesterday. At one point, that used to be a number that would matter to us. But today, it's kind of we shrug our shoulders and say, hey, that's good news. And I'm like, okay, this is really starting to get messed up again.
You're precisely right. And, you know, I just started my research into BA.4 and BA.5.
Oh,
and,
come on. Really? Where are those coming to us from?
Our good friends in South Africa.
Wow, really?
Yeah, and it's showing up in some European countries now too. And again, it's an offshoot of B.1.1.529.2, kind of the original South African Omicron. That has since evolved, and you know, you get to 4 numbers, and then we gotta rename it.
Yeah, we do. Yes, we do. I don't care what you call it, but call it something. I mean, this is it's like a troll account on Twitter. It's just, how many numbers do you have in this thing? It's you just need to go to the next Greek letter. I'm good with that. I think there's still a few we haven't used.
That's right. We got pi coming up, don't we?
Yes.
That was very humorous, by the way, yesterday.
Thank you, sir.
But yeah, once we come up with some very fundamental differences and get to these 4 numbers after the B or the BA, then we move on to a B.4 and a B.5. like we're doing right now. That's what's going on.
Just really quick, if I can ask, B4, B5, is there, I mean, so what I've seen is as these new strains of Omicron come on out, they might be more contagious than previous strains, but they don't seem to be as strong or as far as hospitalizations and deaths. I mean, still there are hospitalizations and deaths, but not at the levels they were before. Is there anything with 4 and 5 that's giving, raising eyebrows and saying, okay, this is different?
Yeah, one of them has about a 64% growth advantage over the original Omicron. The other has about an 85%.
Oh, so, my God.
Yeah. The good thing is there's an upper limit to this. We can't keep, it's not going to go ad infinitum. It's going to plateau off at some point, but then you're going to start seeing other mutations come on. That's where like the L452R and stuff like that and the spike proteins come into play where they can avoid detection or diagnosis or therapeutics, decrease in the effectiveness of public health measures, basically, or they can manifest in other mutations that increase the virulence or clinical disease presentation, the outcomes like the long-term COVID or mortality or things like that, the loading, et cetera. So these buggers, all I know right now is their growth advantage is what's really kind of causing a lot of concern out there. And frankly, I'm quite worried because if we start throwing more mutations on those, and we're really got some problems coming with that added growth advantage. So
our COVID models expert is Dr. Joe Eastman. He's kind enough to join us today. Well, can I bring up an obvious point, of cultural point, which I think kind of concerns me greatly. In December, we had Omicron just starting. It hadn't gotten really bad. And then Spider-Man came on out. And all of a sudden, for the first time in a long time, we had jam-packed movie theaters for a few weeks. Here we are. We're at this precipice again today, actually tonight, Doctor Strange and the Multiverse of Madness, which is a wildly popular movie. I think it's already the top-selling pre-sale movie of the year and one of the top of all time. They're expecting it to possibly be a top 10 opening. That opens tonight and tomorrow. We're just destined at this point to have a repeat of what happened in December and that we are going to see a larger spike due to the fact that people just don't seem to care at this point?
We're certainly headed down that path. A midsummer spike is likely coming again. And I sent you my projections.
Yes.
And there's basically three trajectories we can go on. One is a very low, slow ramp that's quite small, about a tenth of what we saw in January. The other ones are about a seventh of what we saw in January. That's kind of the mean trajectory. And then there's a little bit nastier trajectory, and all these will peak in May sometime, of over 35%. Increase, in cases, and about 35% of what we saw in January, which is still a scary number because you realize we're underreported. So the peak is probably going to be somewhere what January was, for gosh sakes. And then we look at BA4 and 5, and they start making their way here. I think we're looking at July, something like that, where it's Groundhog Day again. Here we go.
And we don't even mention long COVID, that a lot of people are dealing with. That this is, as we talk about this, a lot of people might be asymptomatic. As you say, they might be walking around, they don't know it at all. And henceforth, this is part of the problem, is that there's a lot of people out there not wearing masks, walking around, they don't realize they're sick, and they're giving it to everyone else. And as that's happening, the reality is that not only are we dealing with the people that are getting what I guess we could call short-term COVID, which is the standard COVID, you're getting it within 10, 15 days, hopefully you're better and you're moving on, you don't have to get hospitalized or anything. But the reality is that we still don't know the impact of these new variants on long COVID, and we could still have a lot of people in 2-3 years still sick from getting sick in the next few weeks.
Yeah, the effects on the brain are really starting to come into focus now, you know. One in ten. I don't know if you've been following the White House Correspondents' Dinner, that whole thing. They filled up that room with all those people. CO2 levels just spiked. They're in the 2,000 parts per million range. Everybody's breathing on each other, talking, laughing, having a good time. There's no ventilation in there. All of a sudden, we're starting to see, you know, even Blinken has COVID now. Mm-hmm. And they acted like, oh, it's just going to be fine. We're all vaccinated. We're all safe. And I don't know what the hell they were thinking doing that. It was a bad example. That's not leadership.
Well, and the reality, too, is I'll say this. I work in a radio station, and all my best to, let me see if I can remember, Chad Hartman. Dan Barrero, who's the guy that used to do sports over on
Mark Rosen.
Mark Rosen, all these guys. If you do our job, you are sitting in a studio. And I still today, Dr. Joe, I get people's like, oh, can I come in for the interview? I'm like, no, you do not come into the studio for the interview. I mean, with all due respect to you, it's not that I don't want to see you. You look delightful. You could be a good conversation, but I can do this over the phone. Because I'm realizing, and I think there you go. You know, Baldolli, the coach for the Twins, he's out now. You know, and then all of a sudden you have to ask the question: how many players was he close to and breathing on? It is expanding. I'm seeing it in my kid's school with the notifications that I'm getting, which were down to zero, and all of a sudden about 2 weeks ago they started in, and now it's like 3 or 4 a day that we're getting.
Oh my gosh, I didn't know that.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, I hope your children are safe.
Well, Rose is sick. My youngest indeed has got COVID, but I tested negative. My everyone else is. She's going through protocol right now. She's locked in her dungeon. I mean room, and she's she's fine there. But and of course she's got my cooking, so she seems to be quite happy with that. And an iPad, so more movies and TV that she gets to watch. But. But no, it is kind of one of those things where it's like, you know, this is, if you're not taking it seriously, even we take it seriously. My daughter is very good about wearing a mask in school and when she's, you know, around groups of people, and she's still got this. It is scary. I do want to say this. I mean, we can't stop people from going to the movies or anything like that. You and I can't. We can just do what we've always done. Get vaccinated. Get boosted. I love that the article you sent about the concerns about leakage on face masks. You want to put a good tight face mask seal on those N95s, work pretty well. And you can and basically be safe that way.
They should leave a nice mark on your face.
Never mind. I can't do that joke. All right. I can't do that joke. Dr. Joe, at this point, though, look, let's just say BA2, the BA2.1.2.2, whatever it is, if these go through their course and the other variants don't pop up, what's your timeline? You're hoping by, June, that we might be able to on the backside of this again?
Right, exactly. Everything about the third week of this month, maybe the fourth week, should be peaked and over and on the decline. And my July outlook right now, because I don't have these other variants in there, it looks like the background kind of sitting there and waiting to pop up if it possibly can, as vaccines age more and natural immunity ages after 3-4 months, it's pretty much gone. You might see a little uptick caused by that. But in July, we could be okay, but my intuition tells me we're going to repeat the same stuff we've been doing. So
last thing I want to ask you, you're up north there, outside of Grand Rapids, right?
Yeah.
Is the snow finally gone? Are you still got snow out there?
It's just a trace from big banks, and my first day of wearing shorts of 2022. Well, this is great.
You enjoy. Dr. Joe Eastman, it is an absolute privilege and a pleasure to have you on. By all means, I look forward to the next time you and I can chat, because I do appreciate your science, your numbers, and your honesty. They're all appreciated here on this show. Thank you, sir.
Thank you very much. You have a good day.
You too. Dr. Joe Eastman. Dr. Joe joining us. Let's take a break. Come back. How about this? Cliff Schechter, when we do come back, 952-946-6205. 952-946-6205. It's the Matt McNeil Show right here on AM 950.
Hey, boy. What you say, boy?
The progressive voice of Minnesota, the Matt McNeil Show. Cliff Schechter, kind enough to join us. Of course, you can follow him on YouTube with the Cliff Schechter page there. It is delightful. He's got a new article out in the New Republic, Blue Amp Strategies. Talk about messaging for your business, for your campaign. Blue Amp Strategies is there to help. Cliff Schechter, kind enough to join us from Ohio on a Thursday. Hey, Cliff.
Hey, man. How are you?
I'm doing very well, man. When the Alito ruling came down, the first thing I said is, oh, I got to imagine Cliff is going nuts. That this is something you have been screaming about for years, that this is what their end game was. And I just want to remind everyone, in this ruling that was leaked, at one point Alito refers to a guy from 1644 in England who liked to burn witches at the stake as part of his successful modern-day argument on why Roe v. Wade should be overturned. I mean,
makes sense.
Oh, yeah, of course. Let's go back to Copernicus and see what he has to say. You know, it's just...
They would have burned him at the stake, too.
I think they would have. At least a good stoning. Yeah. You know, it's ludicrous. I mean, it's precedent because it's the Supreme Court, so they can say it and it happens. But the entire argument that they're using is just absolute garbage. And it seems designed to basically say, you know, send a cannonball over the bow to say there's a lot of other things we're about to dismantle in this country from the last 50 years.
Yes, exactly right. I mean, look, I could sit down, you know, actually my children are too old now, but I could have sat them down a couple of years ago with crayons and let them draw out whatever they felt like. And it would have made as much sense as Alito's argument did here. I mean, he's a right-wing nut. He's a right-wing extremist. You know, one of the furthest right. I mean, even on this court, on this crazy court that's further to the right than any court in over 100 years. And at one point, a number of these guys were rated the most conservative justices. I think we had 5 of the 6 most conservative justices of the last 75 years or something of that nature. He, even on that court, has distinguished himself. He, Gorsuch, and Thomas are on this far right, insane wing of this court that I'm not sure there's really almost anything that they wouldn't do. And so there's so much to say, I don't even know where to go. I mean, it reminds you, and he's like, at one point he mentions, he gets into privacy and Griswold and tries to make everybody feel better. It's, oh, but don't worry, we're not talking about that here. We're just talking about Roe. No, you're not. The right to privacy that exists in Roe was built upon the Griswold case, which gives women the right to get contraception. By the way, they used to have to go and like ask for permission from their husbands and that kind of thing. And so it reminds me nothing so much as their and I'm on your show, so I won't curse their BS case with, you know, back in Bush v. Gore, where they're like, so this should be applied to nothing else. It doesn't set precedent. It's just for this one thing. Yeah, that's not the way the law works. We've had a judicial coup, and that's really what it should be called, for the last 20, 25 years now. You know, of right-wing, ridiculous court decisions that are based entirely on what the Federalist Society wants the outcome to be. We're talking about a secret cabal with all their conspiracies. Let's talk about these right-wing elite nuts getting together and planning out the course for the country, even though they're far in the minority. You know, they haven't won a popular vote. They've won one popular vote since 1988, and they barely won it in the re-election of George W. Bush. And let's face it, with how many votes they suppressed, who knows? And yet they found a way to steal seats, as McConnell has done, and get their folks in, losing the popular vote, and using the Supreme Court that they had at that time because of Reagan to give George W. Bush the court. And this is where we end up. And if people, again, you know, you said the end goal, this was one of their end goals, but it is by no means their end goal. They are trying, and if you saw them, Alito himself mentioned Obergefell mm-hmm. in there. He mentioned that decision. There's the right to marriage equality. They're coming for your marriage if you're gay and you're married. They're coming for your love life. Lawrence versus Kansas. That's not the overturning of sodomy laws. That's not safe. No, they're coming for that.
Exactly.
They're going to tell you who you can love, how you can love them, which, by the way, is probably going to be very tough on Madison Cawthorn, but that's a whole other thing.
You're saying it perfectly. It's just this Federalist Society, all these people, it's two things that they are obsessed about: regulating people's private bedrooms and making sure they have sex the way they want them to have sex, and correct. Basically turning women back into a subservient part of the population. Let's remind everyone, when Roe v. Wade came around, still a year later, a woman needed a husband's approval to get a credit card in 1974.
Did you see that video that I shared today where Alyssa Milano talked all about that?
Yeah.
You know, exactly what you're saying right now, exactly how abortion was actually legal in this country until the American Medical Association, at that time staffed by all old white straight Christian guys, decided they needed to reassert control over all medical procedure and which would include women's bodies and everything else, and therefore decide that abortion was to be made illegal. I mean, once you learn the history of it, you understand it has nothing to do with babies. Look up at 10 weeks what we're talking about. We're talking about a clump of cells the size of a strawberry. Okay, we're not talking about choice here. We're not talking about difficult decisions that if we would depoliticize them, that have to be made later on because a woman's life might be in danger or a woman's health might be in danger, when we're talking about later on when you're actually having a debate if we've gotten towards where it's a child yet. No, we're talking about 6 weeks, 10 weeks, periods of time where it's absolutely nothing close to a child. It's nothing close to it's barely at that point a fetus. We're talking about a clump of cells. And one of these guys, one of the senators from North Dakota, not far from you, just came out and said that if a woman's life is in danger, well, the baby at 10 weeks, the clump of cells comes first, and she should be left to die. Yeah. That is what Hovind, one of these idiots. Again, this is what it's always been about. It is, and that's why the witch trials actually fit in perfectly. Yeah. Those were women who often were single, who were older, who were different, and weren't religious. And so they needed to show everybody else that this is the way you're supposed to do it. Mm-hmm. And now they're showing everybody else this is the way you're supposed to do it. Like, you need to be like the 1950s. You need to be getting married, men and women. You need to be having sex when we tell you to, how we tell you to. Of course, none of that applies to us because numerous members of who we're talking about have either taken spouses or taken, you know, mistresses to get abortions or pressured them to. We know. Yeah. The number of them are serving as Republicans in Congress right now.
Exactly.
I'll finish off and just say that's what this is all about in the end. It's this elite group that are above everybody else, who are right-wing nuts, who think that they get to determine how everybody else lives their lives. But for them, they can make whatever exceptions. They can live however they choose to live.
I will say this without a doubt, too, that in these Republican, far-right Republican states, that wealthy white Republican donors and their wives – and their husbands will be able to go into a clinic in those states where abortion is supposedly legal and get an abortion at will. This is not about outlawing abortion for everyone. They'll just find it as a different kind of procedure or something of that magnitude. But trust me, abortions will still be going on in these states, but they'll only be for wealthy white people who basically donate to Republican campaigns.
Oh, and they'll still be going on for other people. They'll just be going on in back alleys and women will be dying.
That's
exactly what will be happening. We don't use the language that we need to use. They'll be killing women with this decision. That's what they'll be doing, because they're telling you, you have no right to have sex. You have no right to do this. You have no right to any of this. You know, but these are the people that are screaming and yelling about freedom because somebody wants to make them wear a mask on a damn airplane so they don't get me and my family sick.
Yeah.
But a woman is essentially a baby container, mm-hmm. as far as they're concerned, and really not a clump of cells container is what she is. She's a petri dish.
Well, and let me also add in here that, I mean, there have been a few Republicans who have come on out and been very vocal. But I want to actually make the point that there's a lot of Republicans that it's, as I described it, it's the dog catching the car. They've got this. They all of a sudden realize this is an issue that 60 to 80% of the country wants to stay legal. They're on the
including wrong side. A 39, so let's call it 40, about 40% of Republicans.
Two
in five Republicans want this to be legal.
And so
go ahead. Sorry.
That brings up the point. I mean, there's a lot of Republicans, especially Republicans in leadership positions, who right now are really quiet because they quite don't know how to in the world that they're going to go on out there and sell this in, especially districts where they know this has all of a sudden put them at a disadvantage.
Oh, I mean, if anything is going to galvanize younger people, if anything's going to galvanize single women, even married women in suburbs, if anybody's going to galvanize those who are well-educated, moderates, any really just most normal people to want to come out and say, are you kidding me? I think that this will be that thing. Mm. And, you know, whoever leaked it and whatever their reasoning was, don't really care. I mean, it's funny. They want to try to pin this on the left. I mean, that's part of their trying to hide, you know, to move the issue to the leak, mm-hmm. you know, which in the end, you know, I'm suspicious somebody conservative leaked it because I think they wanted the outrage to hopefully get out of everybody's systems right now so that maybe people wouldn't be as outraged when the decision actually comes down.
And they wanted to stop Roberts from trying to convince Kavanaugh to basically change his opinion. I think that had a lot to do with it too. I think this came from Alito's office, and I think that someone there saw that Roberts was out there trying to convince Kavanaugh to go with a lighter version of this, and so he leaked it to basically box in Kavanaugh.
Right. And again, look, this isn't hard to figure out. You brought up my YouTube channel, which everybody, of course, should go and subscribe to right now. www.youtube.com/CSchecter, CSCHECTER. But now I'll continue. I've been doing a 5-part series that's called Why the Supreme Court Sucks. And the first part was on Alito. It's amazing what you learn when you start going back through and you remind yourself, oh, that's right. He was on the Concerned Alumni of Princeton. Whose main gripe was they were letting too many women in because they had a problem with co-equal, you know, co-education and women having as much access as men. It was okay to let some women in, you know what I mean? But the place should still be dominated by good old, and they didn't want to say it, good old white men, because guess what else they were fighting? Affirmative action. God forbid somebody whose granddaddy and great-granddaddy didn't go there have the right to go there and not get into the affirmative action of my family's rich and white. So that's his background. We know Clarence Thomas's background, pubic hair on coke and long dunk silver and Anita Hill and the rest of them. We know Kavanaugh's PJ and Squee
beer.
And the gang get drinking beer, Senator, and getting drunk and lifting weights and then going and holding a woman down, yeah. Christine Blasey Ford, and putting their hand over her mouth and exposing himself. I don't know if I'm allowed to say that was the word of what he exposed on your radio show, so I won't. Exposing himself to, you know, putting his, you know what, a woman's face in a, you know, at a fraternity, all the other things, and apparently we now know because the FBI refused to look into any of this because they were told not to because it was Trump's FBI. We know that there were hundreds of tips that were called in. Mm-hmm. They didn't follow up on any of this. They did a 1-week investigation. Like, who knows how many of these cases are out there with Kavanaugh? So there's three men. I haven't even looked into to everybody else's records there yet. Nice. You know what I mean? I've just started with these two, and I happen to know with Clarence Thomas and Alito, and I happen to know the story of Kavanaugh, because how can you not? But yeah. I'm sure there's stuff there with Gorsuch too, you know, and Roberts for that matter. I mean, that these guys made clear early in their careers and throughout their careers that they have a bias that women are second-class citizens. So no one should be surprised that that's the conclusion they're coming to.
It'll be interesting when you get to Representative Amy Salem Witch Trial. She'll be a fun hoot. Now, let's go to your article in New Republic. Of course, our view here, you're in Ohio. J.D. Vance, which I am stunned even in the Republicans. What the heck happened to that state? Why is Ohio now, you know, getting further and further into this kind of like South Dakota type of Republicanism?
Well, I mean, that was the point that I was – some of the point I was trying to make there, and I pointed out this is not the conservatism of Taft or Voinovich. This is what gerrymandering does. This is what voter suppression does. I mean, the breakdown these days tends to be what's your urban-suburban population versus your exurban-rural population. Right. And so you get a state like Pennsylvania. They've got a city in Philadelphia with, what, 2 million people. And so Pennsylvania is a swing state. It even leans Democratic. We don't have that here, right? We've got three states. You know, there's exceptions to this rule. Obviously, Vermont is a liberal state and it's largely rural. I'm not saying there's no exceptions, but that's the general breakdown. We have three cities here of 300,000 to 400,000 or so, you know, that don't even make up a Philadelphia. And so, but we have enough folks in college towns too, and in the suburbs that have been moving to the left. I mean, my area, the Cincinnati suburbs, have been moving further and further to and not further to the left, away from a crazy Republican Party. These are moderates, a lot of them, right? And but what they've done, because they've been able to do this, because they've gerrymandered so that some people don't even feel like their vote matters, because they've pulled these stunts where they send some mail to your house, and if you don't answer it within a few months, and they say, oh, you must not be a real voter, and they cut you off the rolls. I mean, they've done everything they can to accentuate the power the right has here. This state normally is, if you're being honest, is about a 52-48 Republican state. And if they weren't fighting what we all voted for and trying to overthrow, really ignore the Supreme Court right now and not redraw the lines, if they were to redraw the lines, you'd see something a lot different, because most people would have a reason to come out and vote. There'd be a lot of swing seats. You know what I mean? And in the end, that ends up changing everything. And so that's what this state truthfully is. And it should be electing, if it's electing conservatives, it's in that older mold. But instead, they came in here and they all kissed Trump's ring. And in the end, you know, the James Bond villain himself, we now know, dumped in through various entities $15 million. And here Peter Thiel bought himself a Senate seat. I mean, that's all it was. Peter Thiel delivered $15 million to J.D. Vance. And because he's buddy-buddy with Trump, he delivered Trump's endorsement. And those two things together were what still only gave J.D. Vance 32% of the vote. Right. Like a guy who ran, one of the guys who ran here, Matt Dolan, this is one of the things that gives me hope, who comes from this old line, kind of wealthy, waspy family up in the Cleveland area, you know, of Republicans, conservative, center right kind of. He ran explicitly as somebody who said that Trump is lying and the election wasn't stolen. And, you know, he's far more conservative than you or I, but at least lives in reality. Look at him as like a Mitt Romney type. He got 23-24% of the Republican vote in the primary. I wouldn't say that that's a gimme to J.D. Vance to win those voters.
Well, then let's put that out there. I mean, you see it on the ground level there. I mean, is there a decent chance the DFL, I call it the DFL because that's what it's here in Minnesota, the Democrats will win in Ohio and get that seat, do you think?
I think there's a terrific chance. I think that Tim Ryan, in much the same way as Sherrod Brown, was built as the type of person to win in this state. You're going up against this, as I said in that New Republic piece, this guy that used to write about his little weekends in San Francisco, sipping wine, you know, up in wine country, and going out to brunches and all this sort of stuff. We decided to pretend, you know, he's a regular guy again and come back here, you know, after he went to Yale too and the rest. And then you've got Tim Ryan, who literally looks like he's comfortable in a biker rally. Right. I mean, like kind of like Sherrod Brown. They're both comfortable wearing denim. They're both comfortable in union halls. And you can tell J.D. Vance is just not right. He's this kid who maybe whatever he was once went to Yale and became this privileged little brat. So, you know, Tim Ryan has a ton of charisma. Watch a couple of his speeches from the House floor and the insurrection or the one in Iraq from back in 2004 or so. If we had nominated certain other folks, I'd be more worried. But if it's a Tim Ryan versus J.D. Vance race, I think we have an excellent shot. And as long as their narrative is the one that I talked about in the New Republic and the ad that Tim Ryan already released saying similar things about who this guy really is, and as long as, you know, they're not able to suppress enough votes, that is always the big question here, then absolutely, I think that Tim Ryan can win.
Will, and final question for you. Do you think the outrage over the Alito ruling will carry over, or do you think it will get burnt out with walks and marches and memes on social media? Do you think that this is they finally crossed the line too far and that people are saying, oh, yeah, I'm marching, but I guarantee you November 8th I'm voting too?
I think so, because again, this is a leaked copy, and so, you know, people are outraged now. They think that's going to suddenly calm down. I don't think it is. I think when their real ruling actually comes out, when it's supposed to come out 2 to 3 months, however long down the line, I think when they start having live hearings in June for the January 6th commission. There's a lot of things going on this summer, and this just adds to that. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, look, that's my hope. I mean, we're Democrats. We find a way to screw things up we shouldn't. We don't message forcefully enough, although I've been seeing some of the younger folks like Eric Swalwell and Ruben Gallego. It's heartening to me. Jump right in there and hit back hard and start messaging in the way that we should be. And if, you know, if we can do that, right, if we can make it a referendum on people who have attacked your economic well-being, have attacked your democracy, who want to allow you to get sick, you know, and want to take away your personal rights, if that's the referendum, I like our chances.
Mm-hmm. Yankees and Twins are the two best teams, I think, in the American League. How about that?
Who could have predicted that? No.
Yankees, okay, but the Twins? Well, the American League Central's garbage, man. It is absolute garbage.
And like, what's his name? Isn't even hitting well, right? Correa?
No, he's not. It's the rest of the team.
Buxton's been awesome.
Yeah, Buxton and Max Kepler has been quite good. So yeah, we're doing good. So good. At least you and I are going to have things to talk about all summer long.
See?
On that. Everything's good. Cliff Schechter.
Let's not talk about the Reds, though.
No, my gosh, it's heartbreaking. My heart.
That owner pissed me off. And
that's breaking.
Don't get
my
me
heart.
Started because I wanted the Reds to be a co-equal and be a huge fan. You know, be a huge fan, and I have been a fan of theirs. And like, he should be forced to sell the damn team. What they've done to this town, it makes me angry. Let's just say that.
Cliff Schechter's articles in the New Republic. I'll post a link to that. I'll post a link to the video you would also put out there. And of course, go subscribe to the YouTube page. I'll put that out there as well after the show. Cliff, as always, thank you much. I appreciate the time, my friend.
Thanks for having me on, buddy. Take care.
Cliff Schechter, kind enough to join us. We'll wrap up hour one when we come back. It's the Matt McNeil Show right here on AM 950.
Billboard, baby, do a leap and make them dance when they come on. Everybody looking for a dance floor to run on. If you want to run
away with me, I know what to do. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. It's the Matt McNeil Show. By the way, just a quick little side note to you. If you're used to watching the live stream on Progressive Citizen X Matt McNeil Show, it's down today. Just go watch it on AM 950 radio. Just go watch it on AM 950 radio. We are broadcasting live. It's radio for your eyes, kids. So off you go. Enjoy me? I don't know. Thank you very much to Todd Colet, who is sponsoring AM 950 all this week. Todd, of course, lived here in Minneapolis. He moved to Spain, and I'll tell you one thing. The commute to the Park Tavern is a little bit of a beast if you're in Spain. And so he wanted to help out the radio station. He does by sponsoring the radio station once a month. You can too, by the way. 952-946-8885. 952-946-8885. And here's the deal. He is friends with a guy named Paul Nyland. Nyland is over in Kyiv. In Ukraine, and he's for 19 years run Lifeline Ukraine. It's a mental health and suicide prevention hotline, obviously in desperate need right now. They need help. If you can give it, not only are they trying to help all the citizens there on limited funds, they're under attack themselves. So please, if you can, go to Lifeline Ukraine. I put a link up on the social media pages on Twitter and on the Progressive Citizen X Matt McNeil Show Facebook page. Make a donation, apparently just for your conversion rates here. The 1,500 UAH is about $50. So there is that. So just keep that in mind. So once again, Lifeline Ukraine, help them out if you can. I mentioned Dr. Joe Eastman. We'll spotlight both these interviews, by the way. Fantastic stuff. Dr. Joe is on. We were talking about Baldelli getting COVID. I said, well, how many other people were near him? Well, here you go. Luis Ariz is got COVID, as well as Dylan Bundy, both tested positive for COVID. Bundy is a starting pitcher. I guess he'll be okay. Ariz is a loss. He's been absolutely on fire to begin this season. So we'll have to see if someone else can pick up the slack. They're in Baltimore tonight. We're back hour two and Democrat of the Day up next. The progressive voice of Minnesota. It is the Matt McNeil Show. Hour number two on your Thursday. Once again, interview heavy here. Look for the on your iTunes, on your SoundCloud, and all your favorite iPod places. The interviews with Dr. Joe Eastman, our COVID modeler.
Cliff Schechter, national pundit. They'll be from last hour. They will be up here before too long. And a reminder, too, if you are watching the show, like to watch it on the live stream, the Matt McNeil Show, Progressive Citizen Next Page, that's down today. But it is streaming on AM 950 Radio on Facebook. So bonjour. Go enjoy if you'd like. Democrat of the day. We head down to Senate District 54, Prior Lake area. Alicia Donahue is kind enough to join us. She's the DFLer running for that seat, and she wants to talk a little bit about her campaign. Alicia, thank you very much. I appreciate the time.
Thanks so much for having me, Matt.
My absolute pleasure here. The district here, I'm fascinated about this seat because I'm just from the get-go. This is, on the Republican side, it's kind of a nightmare for the GOP right now. A far-right group has targeted the current Republican seat holder, a guy named Pratt, and they're trying to put a very extremist far-right candidate in there, which is not going to fly in Senate District 54. So as I watch this, and especially in the Republican Party today, I think there's a decent chance there could be an extreme far-right candidate in this district, which means since 54 isn't an extremist far-right district, this is a viable pickup here for the DFL.
You know, I think what it really speaks to is that folks are wanting people at the Capitol who are ready to get things done. And I'm a strong believer that all of the problems we face here in Minnesota can be solved if we work together. And so if we are running far right, far left folks who are not interested in finding any sort of common ground, we're not going to get anywhere. And that's not what Minnesota wants. That's not what's going to make Minnesota better. And that's honestly, that's why I'm running. We need to get things done. We need to help our communities who are struggling, and we need to help the middle class.
Mm-hmm. And you said it perfectly well there. It's just, this is this element that's trying to take over the seat. They are so furious of any kind of compromise or working with the other side that they would rather shut the state government down as opposed to even make any concessions. That's not going to fly. I mean, I should mention, I said Prior Lake here. I get it also. I love Shakopee. Oh, yeah. Crepes. Yeah, I like Shakopee. I go down there a lot. I love that part of town. Prior Lake. Jordan's in this district. This is the new redrawn district, we should say, in 54 here. And it's been trending more and more towards the left. In the last 10 years, I've been doing this radio show. I have seen that district move more and more. It used to be a pretty solid red district, but now it's becoming much more of a toss-up district.
You're absolutely right. This is a seat that can be flipped to the Democrats, to folks who want to get things done in the legislature. Candidates don't win campaigns. People behind the candidates win campaigns, and this seat is exactly that. We're ready to get to work. We're ready to build off the momentum that previous candidates have created, and we're ready to get to the Capitol with some true representation for folks in our community.
So let's introduce everyone. Let's give you a little chance here to give a little bit of a biography of who exactly you are. Who exactly is Alicia Donahue?
Yeah. So I'm a wife. I'm a stepmom. I'm a licensed independent clinical social worker. I'm a community organizer. I'm a social justice advocate. And I've spent 18 years of my life learning about people, getting to know people, and helping people. And that's what I'm planning to do in the Minnesota Senate. I was one of the co-founders of the Women's March here in Minnesota, and I watched firsthand the power that people have when we get together, the power that women have when we organize. Mm-hmm. And I'm excited to do that here in 54 and to really help our community and to make this a stronger Minnesota.
And as a matter of fact, sharp-eared listeners might remember, we actually had you on talking about the march a few years back that was going on because you've been there. And I'm glad to see you're running for office. I especially like the fact that your experience, we need more people with that perspective. We've got a lot of people that are only in St. Paul looking to represent the wealthiest people in their district and their tax dollars, making sure they get tax breaks. They don't get a lot of people in there that are in the real day-to-day experience of seeing the need that's in this state, see government services as they're presented. Because not only do you see the value in these services, but you also see the areas where they can improve those services.
You're so right. The last 18 years of my life has been spent working with folks who are experiencing some of the darkest days. I have been a mental health professional, also known as a therapist, in the Hennepin County Jail System. I am currently a supervisor in child protection investigations. I work with folks who are experiencing severe and persistent mental illness, chemical dependency. I've worked for the state of Minnesota as an advocate for individuals whose rights were being violated in relation to the services they're receiving. And I think that, I mean, you said it best, we've got folks at the Capitol who mean well, because I like to assume positive intent. They mean well with some of the legislation that's coming out, but the reality is our safety nets are failing folks, and we are throwing tax dollars at safety net programs that folks at the Capitol don't know how they're working firsthand. And we know that policy drives practice, and we're spending a lot of money on programs who aren't serving our communities the way that they could. And I'm excited to get to work to dig into those programs, to put money into programs that are actually helping our communities, and to save taxpayers' dollars on programs that just aren't working, but we're hopefully intended to do so, but we just realize aren't hitting the mark.
You know, you bring that up. I remember Tori Westrum, the Republican from out in western Minnesota, and when he was fighting against food stamps, and he didn't understand how the food stamp program worked. You know, he didn't understand it. He was just babbling, and he had no idea how the actual program worked, which made him look foolish, of course, and everything he was saying, and eventually got struck down. But the reality is Republicans have no problem running with stereotypes. When you talk about, hey, you know what? This program can be improved. This program's not working. This program's working fantastic. Your 18 years gives you that viewpoint where you bring the authority in with your arguments.
Absolutely. It absolutely does. And my experience over these last 18 years speaks for itself. And the knowledge that I have about these programs is clear. And I'm excited to get to work, to really help support the communities that are struggling to fix the holes in our safety nets that we're supposed to support folks. And like I said, to save taxpayer money.
Alicia Donnie is joining us, a State Senate District 54 Democrat of the day. Alicia, let's get into a few issues. You actually touched on one with your unique perspective. I'd love to get your thoughts on this. We are on the precipice of a mental health crisis in this city, in this state, in this country that we have never seen before. The pandemic did not help things, and we are really in a problem. We don't have enough staff. We don't have enough counselors. We don't have enough resources. What are some things that you would like to do when you talk about mental health from your perspective that you could say, you know what, this is where we need to focus our attention?
Oh, gosh. How much time do you have, Matt?
I'll give you as much time as you want on that one.
I mean, we could be here all day talking about that. We could start with fully funding our public schools. We have classroom sizes that are not conducive to supporting teachers who are trying to do this work. We don't have nearly enough counselors in our schools, and we don't have enough social workers in our schools. So we, starting at the very youngest Minnesotans, we are failing our communities. We are not addressing the mental health crisis. There are so many barriers when it comes to even supporting folks who want to get into this industry, right? I could sit here and talk about the mountain of student loan debt that I have, that I acquired through my education to become a licensed clinical social worker. You have to have a master's degree, which means you have to go 4 years plus one or two, depending on your undergrad. And so we are failing communities who want to get involved and want to do this work, want to become therapists and counselors, marriage and family therapists, who don't have access to be able to go to college in the first place. And then we have a licensure process that is full of obstacles and hoops that folks have to jump through. It makes it really impossible for folks who want to do this work. And so we have to do better. We have to fully fund these programs. We have to find a way to ensure that we are paying people what they're worth. It is unacceptable to me that we have folks who are working in group homes who are getting paid less than a livable wage, and they are supporting humans, right? We've got folks who are getting paid less than what you get paid at Aldi's, who are handling people's lives in their hands. And you absolutely said it. We are on the precipice here. There's a wait list for every therapist that I know.
Yes.
We have to do something, or we have to start by supporting our youngest Minnesotans, and we have to find a way to encourage those who want to get into this field and not have all of these barriers that prevent them from doing so.
You just brought up something that we have not talked about, but it's such an important element of this problem. Family counselor, individual counselor, children's counselor, there isn't a counselor in this state that doesn't have a waiting list right now. And let's think about that. If you need to go to a counselor, the last thing you need to be told is, we'll put you on standby. You know, it's kind of, you just nailed it. We have this big issue, and I still don't see Republicans, including the current Republican that's holding that seat, trying to do anything to deal with it. And I think this is why we need to get you into St. Paul. I think there's a lot of great reasons to get you into St. Paul. Let's talk about another issue here. Obviously, thing that everyone's talking about lately, and that is the ruling, the Alito ruling that's been leaked from the Supreme Court in regards to the overturning of Roe v. Wade. Minnesota, of course, through Doe versus Gomez, was a court case that actually enshrined stricter rights for women, more rights for women in the state constitution, which is great because Minnesota is going to, you know, basically be able to weather this. A lot of states won't. Republicans are vowing that, you know, we just had Dr. Scott Jensen that was, he did an interview where he basically said, even in the case of rape and incest, women will not have the choice of being able to get an abortion if he becomes the governor of the state of Minnesota. Talk about women's reproductive rights and the impact of the Alito ruling on your mentality as you think about heading to St. Paul.
Oh boy. I mean, make no mistake about it. What this is about women's rights. This is about the right of women and those with uteruses telling us that we are not equal, that we don't have the right to make decisions about our reproductive health care. That's really what we're talking about here. And when we are in a country that has the highest maternal mortality rate, we have no paid maternity leave. You know, universally, we have no universal health care. We have no subsidized child care. We have inaccessible mental health care. What are we doing? It's absolutely unacceptable. We are setting up future generations to fail. We are failing our current generations, and we're setting up. I am infuriated by it, and I'm also fueled by it. Because, like I said earlier, I know the power of women. I know our power to organize and our power to fight. I saw what 34 women in a library in Eagan did in November of 2016, and how we spent less than 8 short weeks to bring 100,000+ people to our capital. I know that when we put our minds to something, we can better our lives, our communities, our children's lives. But we have to fight. We have to say we're not willing to accept this, because at the end of the day, it's not going to be women or those with uteruses who are in positions of power or privilege. Let's just be real clear. This is about protecting and supporting communities that have lower socioeconomic statuses, communities that can't afford to drive 3 states away to be able to access reproductive health care. And that's simply unacceptable.
Yeah, and we haven't even mentioned the underlying elements of this whole thing, which is, you know, the Republicans want to go into your private bedroom and regulate what goes on in there. They wanted to return women to the time where the husbands had to be, you have to sign off on women being able to do things. There are so many cases under that Alito ruling. It's not just the women's right of choice. It is every right, almost every right women have gotten in the Supreme Court was through the 14th Amendment on liberty there. And Alito's trying to undo that, as well as the conservative justices. There are going to be, if Minnesota, I hope, stays safe, because we've got to get the DFLers in there in majority. But the reality, there are going to be some nightmare zones across this country after these conservatives get done with that Supreme Court.
You're absolutely right, and we have to do something. We have to protect our rights here in Minnesota, and we have to show up in November to elect folks who are willing to say enough is enough. We need equality. We need health care. We need reproductive health care. We need to support families. We need to support women. We need to support our youngest Minnesotans who are failing. We have to do better, and I know we can do better, but we have to work together to solve these problems. And by electing folks who are not willing to even hear where the other side is coming from is a problem. And that's why I think social workers are in such a unique position to run for office, because it's literally what I do all day, every day, is listen to people, hear where they're coming from, and find out how to find a solution to the problems that they're facing.
One last thing, if I can, because you brought this up. You talk about one side's trying to help, one side's not. Let's go to education funding. I thought Education Minnesota put out a very stark graphics through it when they compared what every school district in the state would have gotten under the DFL plan, which was a varying amount of money depending on the size of the school district, and how much they got with the Republican plan, which was zero for the entire state. Every school district in the state got $0 from Republicans. You just mentioned it. We aren't underfunding our schools, and the Republicans are basically putting their fingers in the air, screaming, "I can't!" in their ears and screaming, "I can't hear you! I can't hear you!"
Nobody wins if we fail our children. Our children, as cliche as it is, our children are our future, and if we are not fully funding our schools, then we are not fully investing in our future leaders. I've talked about this openly quite often, that my high school guidance counselor is somebody who saw, despite the many barriers and obstacles that I was facing in my life, she encouraged me to pursue a college education. She saw something in me that I couldn't see in myself, and then I went on to become the first master's level graduate in my family. So I know firsthand the importance our teachers and our school counselors have on the lives and the futures of our children. So honestly, anything less than fully funded schools is just unacceptable.
Absolutely. I really like you. I want you in St. Paul. You are exactly the kind of senator that, I mean, you win your seat. You could be the deciding seat that the DFL could win back the Senate and get some real change done, as opposed to what's going on with the Republicans in the Senate today. I really, really, I'm going to put about a big support here for Alicia Donahue. Once again, this is Senate District 54, Shakopee, Prior Lake, Jordan, that part of the metro area. Donations, volunteers. Alicia, it comes down to this. If you have the volunteers to knock on every door in that district, you'll win, correct?
Absolutely, we will.
Yeah. It comes down to that. I mean, how much? That's a seat the DFL can pick up. So donations, if people want to donate or volunteer, find out more about your campaign, Alicia. How do they do that?
Follow me on all social media platforms, Alicia, FOR54. My website right now goes straight to my Act Blue, so alicia454.com will bring you there. My website will be up and running here shortly. Send me an email if you're interested in getting connected, or send me a message on any social media platform. My email is going to be Alicia, A-L-I-C-I-A, at alicia454.com.
And when I post this interview, I will link to your Twitter page, your Facebook page. Just go to that and make a message and say, hey, how do I volunteer? How do I help you out? That's the way to do it. A lot of things have to happen, but we have to vote and we have to help these DFLers win these seats. That is the most important thing, because that's how change and fixing a lot of the problems that we have right now, that's how that happens. Alicia Donahue, Senate District 54. All my best. Thank you very much for the time. I really appreciate it. And thanks for being Democrat of the Day.
Thanks so much, Matt. It's been a pleasure.
An absolute pleasure. Alicia Donahue, 54, Senate District 54. We'll take a break. Come on back. Your thoughts on that interview. 952-946-6205. 952-946-6205. It's the Matt McNeil Show right here on AM 950. Are you remote?
Wow, this has been a fun show so far.
informative. Ooh, you know, someone should put this on the air someplace. Wow, this would be great. 952-946-6205. 952-946-6205. Patrick, are you ready to sweat, man? Are you ready? I mean, not like we're going to have to, like, work out or anything like that. It's going to actually get kind of sucky hot here coming up early next week.
Well, I guess we'll just have to bring it on.
Ah, 81 on Monday, 73 on Tuesday, 81 on Wednesday. Do you remember, God, I'll never forget as long as I live. A few years back, we hit that weird day in April where it got above 100 degrees. Do you remember that?
I don't remember that, actually.
It was weird because my daughter had a softball game. And, I mean, you kind of work your way into that a little bit. You know, you kind of, you know, get a few 80s, maybe a 90 or two. It's getting hot. And then all of a sudden, it's there. Those poor kids, oh, they were just dying out there. They didn't cancel the game. If we cancel the game, we just got the fields dry. Oh, and they dried out. I'm glad we are warming up here. But as Sven always said that spring and autumn are kind of myths in Minnesota. You know, they don't really exist like they do in other places. I've got the band plant sale, my kids' school's band plant sale. I'm excited, man. I'm starting to plot out the garden. I'm starting to plot where things are going to go. I've got some ornamental grasses, got all that taken care of. Looking forward to that. I've got to get, you know, keep this between you and I, Patrick. Okay. Mother's Day coming up here this weekend. Did you know that?
I did know that.
Well, okay. You got something? You set to go there?
Well, it's going to be kind of a busy Mother's Day weekend for me, so kind of probably dinner instead of brunch is going to be my plan.
A crave case can serve too. I love a little White Castle. Mom, White Castle says, I love you.
No, just bring home Taco Bell.
Beef and cheddars from Arby's? No, you love her, so no, that don't do that. Why is she bawling? Well, I bought her some beef and cheddars. Oh, okay. That would explain a lot right there. It is Mother's Day. I will put out the plea here. If you do not, because I already know, as I just said that, I guarantee you at least a few people in this metro area went, what? Yeah, that's right. Mother's Day coming up here this weekend. Call Park Tavern. They got that Mother's Day brunch. That's fantastic. It's wonderful. Done it many years. Great food. You get an hour of bowling with every reservation. And it's Mom's Day because that's the best part is you can take Mom out onto the lanes. You get a little bowling in. Mwah! It works like a charm. And you don't have to clean. You don't have to cook. You don't have to beg an Uber guy to go deliver something for you. It's done. Park Tavern. That's where you need to go. ParkTavern.net. That's ParkTavern.net. I've got to go on out. I got to go buy some flowers. Make sure everything looks pretty. I can't say what it is. I don't want this to get back to her. So I got a t-shirt that's very funny that is coming away. I'll share it with you next week after Mother's Day, but I'm looking forward to it. Happy Mother's Day coming up here to all the moms out there and all my best to all the families as you head into this weekend. 952-946-6205, 952-946-6205. Let's take a break. Come on back. I'm actually going to get into some other news when we do return. It is the Matt McNeil Show right here on AM 950. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. It is the Matt McNeil Show. 952-946-6205. 952-946-6205. The mother of Dante Wright, the black driver fatally shot by a Brooklyn Center police officer last year, said she was assaulted Wednesday night by an officer in the city where her son was killed. According to the activist group Families Supporting Families Against Police Violence, Katie Wright was assaulted by a Brooklyn Center officer while recording a police interaction on Facebook Live. The video shows her recording from across two lanes of highway, broadcasting the scene of an apparent traffic stop involving several officers. Now, I'm going to sit here and just say, I do not blame her for doing this, considering what happened to her son. That is a very, do you want to know the truth? I commend her. She doesn't want the same thing happening to anyone else where, you know, they basically pull the car over for garbage reasons to basically just go on out there and, you know, harass black people. And then in the tragic case of Dante Wright, basically can't figure out the difference between a taser and a pistol. And they end up killing him. So I don't blame her for, you know, walking the streets of Brooklyn Center with a camera waiting for any police interaction, because she's trying to prevent or at least document any, you know, incidences where there possibly could be other problems. At one point during the video, one of the officers crosses the busy highway lanes, speaks to Wright, and appears to grab her hand. The activist group says the encounter left Wright's wrist injured. I don't know why. If she's sitting on a public property, she is more than entitled to film what's going on. While there is no recording audio during the encounter of the officer, he allegedly told Wright that she was under arrest for obstruction of justice for videotaping the officers and that she would receive two tickets in the mail. In Minnesota, it is not illegal to record police officers so long as it doesn't get in the way of the investigation, once again, across two lanes of traffic. Okay, so this is what I think what we're seeing here is this is a police officer who's just angry at being filmed. And so basically decides to go out of his way to cross the street to go confront someone who's filming them and making the argument that you are somehow interfering with their investigation. That is just absolute garbage. Once I told him who I was, he let me go, Wright said in the later portion of the video with audio. I just pulled over nicely, making sure these people end up safe because we know Brooklyn Center kills people. Katie Wright's son died on April 11th of 2021 when former Brooklyn Center police officer Kim Potter fatally shot him during a traffic stop. In court, she said that she meant to use her taser and didn't mean to shoot Wright. Earlier this year, a jury convicted Potter of manslaughter. She was sentenced to 16 months in prison. Well, on Thursday afternoon, Families Supporting Families Against Police Violence is slated to hold a press conference at the Brooklyn Center Police Station. Katie Wright, Mayor Mike Elliott, and Attorney Jeff Storms will discuss what happened Wednesday evening. You're a police officer. I get it. But, I mean, the reality is if your body camera is on all the time when you have an interaction, you should not care at all about, and you're not doing anything wrong, and you're not doing anything wrong, you shouldn't care at all about people filming you. And as a matter of fact, isn't that our world today? I talked about this. I was over by Ridgedale in one of the strip malls there, and I came out of a store, and a car, woman accidentally confused drive with reverse. It does happen. She drove right into a store, crashed right into it. As I am running to go try to help this woman, I pass a bunch of people whose first instinct was to take out their cameras and take pictures. As I ran past one of them, I said, stop taking damn pictures. I don't think I used the clean words. Call 911, you idiot. You know, just all of a sudden dawned, like, oh, yeah, I guess I could help someone, as opposed to, hey, here's a great video of someone dying on TikTok. Now, no one died. She was minorly injured, but that was it. It was an accident. But that's our world today. And if you're a police officer, you have to know that, okay, say in that case, where someone accidentally drives into a building, you're going to respond to that. There's going to be 12 cameras on you just because, look, there's a car in that store. It's now a drive-thru. If you're in Brooklyn Center or you're in Minneapolis, if you in either one of those, you got to know that anytime you pull someone over, there are cameras all over your actions. Brooklyn Center and Minneapolis have had a bit of an issue. It'd be one thing if you are out in, say, rural Minnesota and you've never had a problem, there's never been any complaints, no one's ever doing anything, and all of a sudden you notice someone is following you and videotaping you. But at the same time, it's legal to do so as long as you're not interfering with the actions and you're on public property. They can do that. Something I think a good cop would know and just tolerate, because that's part of the deal. 952-946-6205. I bring this up because I also wanted to bring up something here in regards to the Duluth Police Department. On Wednesday, the Duluth Police Department released a statement summarizing what it says is a third-party researcher found after looking at its policing practices in regard to interactions with people of color in the Duluth community. The third party was hired after the Duluth chapter of the NAACP, or NAACP president held a press conference in the community in March, accusing the Duluth Police Department of years of racially biased policing during interactions with the BIPOC community. The Duluth Police Department says it took the NAACP's claim seriously and hired a third party called Police Strategies LLC in July of last year. According to Police Strategies LLC's CEO, the company uses data science and technology to support effective reforms, reduce risks, and improve performance. After Police Strategies reviewed the Duluth Police Department's data, it released a 172-page demographic disparity analysis on March 30th of this year. The DPD, the Duluth Police Department, says that the third-party company found no evidence to suggest systemic practices of biased policing or racial profiling occurred within the Duluth Police Department after the Police Strategy CEO, Bob Scales, delivered the presentation with the results. Okay. All right. I want to stop, really. It's kind of been proven the nature of policing has a level of discriminatory standards that are in there. And it has been proven that even in the best case scenario, and this is, I'm not necessarily disparaging any specific cop in Duluth. Well, the guy that shot through the door seemed to be kind of a fool, but there are police officers that insist they don't have any intent, but yet when they get behind a vehicle, and if this has been proven time and time again, they get behind a vehicle where a person of color, an African-American, Latino, Native American, is driving the car. And all of a sudden, they don't look at that car like they do when I am driving the car. Big white guy. Big white guy. They look, big white guy. All right. Type in my license plate. No, I don't see anything here. Not by me yet. But all of a sudden, when a lot of it's been proven, not necessarily, I mean, I'm not pointing to anything specific, but there have been studies on policing across the country. They will see an African-American driving a car, and all of a sudden they look at the tabs, they look at the taillights, they look at the condition, they look at the tire tread, they look at everything. Is there an air freshener hanging from the front windshield wiper, windshield rearview mirror? Is there a crack in the windshield? Did they signal their turns? Were they 1 mile over the speed limit in the zone? Did they not brake as you felt like they should have? I mean, my goodness. I mean, we talk about, and I'm going to bring this back to the Minneapolis Police Department. We're going to talk about the fact that the Minneapolis Police Department, I'll give you a great example. How many times did the Minneapolis Police Department harass someone and say, oh, I smell dope, and they start investigating the car and, eh, there's no dope here. So did you just make that up, or is your nose not really a scientific tool? What is it here? You know, is what's going on there? Now, that is an example of Minneapolis, as the Minnesota Department of Human Rights has said through their report, is atrocious. I'm not saying that's Duluth, but I find it very hard that you can come out and say found no evidence to suggest systemic practices of biased policing or racial profiling occurred in the Duluth Police Department. I would buy your report a little bit more if they said, of course, there is a little bit here. Sure. There are some problems, particularly in not just the Black community, the Native American community up there is fairly large in the Duluth area. I would buy your argument. It's like, yeah, there is still some cases. We're working on it. Okay. Nothing to see here. Nothing. We have a sterling reputation. Really? That would go against a lot of studies and stuff out there. And granted, maybe not specifically against the Duluth Police Department, but there is an element of discriminatory tactics within policing that just does exist. Let me read this next part here. The Duluth Police Department has dedicated, caring professional police officers who we hire for their charter are guided by best practices policy, led by ethical leaders, and dedicated to continuous improvement of our training to show up In professional, respectful, and just manner, Duluth Police Chief Mike Tuscan wrote in a statement, "Biased policing of any kind has no quarter here. We have the courage to confront attitudes and behaviors that do not uphold our mission and social contract. Disparities are not a statistic or a spreadsheet. To us, it is someone's life, and we must all do everything we can and more to build an equitable community." That said, disparities do not unilaterally equate to bias by Duluth Police Department. Duluth Police Department and the community benefited from the study. As we have previously stated, the starting point for a continuing conversation with our community in addressing the drivers of disparity in Duluth. Can we go, by the way, I want to make a point here. I like how this police chief has said this. Because he's saying, no, it's still a work in progress. I almost think that he himself is kind of like, yeah, all right, fine. There's probably still one or two things we need to work on. But he kind of addresses that. Bias policing of any kind has no quarter here. We have the courage to confront attitudes and behaviors that do not uphold our mission and social contract. How tough is that for a police department to do, Minneapolis? How tough is that to do? And basically, it's a starting point for continuing conversations with their community. Now, once again, I'm not saying that there aren't problems up in Duluth, but and with all due respect to the people that did the study, come on, it's a large metro area. There's going to be something there. I'd be expecting some level of problem, but at the same time, it's not. And let's be honest here. Can you imagine what this research department would have found if they looked into Minneapolis? Seriously, can you imagine what they would have found? I mean, would they have come back, or would they have come back there with saying, "Oh, well, we didn't find anything"? Didn't you? I got the Stallings tape to show you then, because you clearly didn't see the Stallings tape, because it's horrible. It really is. An organization known as the Duluth Law Enforcement Accountability Network, or LEAN. If you want to put Duluth in there, it's got to be DELEAN. I'm just going to let you know if you're going to go with an acronym. Responded to the findings, saying the statement that it uncovered significant concerns about the ethics and credibility of police strategies, data, methodologies. After the group said it had contracted experts in law enforcement data to review it, LEAN claims in his background research that two directors of police strategies do not have degrees in statistics and have had careers in law enforcement and prosecution, adding that he believes the businesses use fraud methodologies. Well, that would be a problem. The organization adds that Duluth chapter president of the NAACP, Classy Dudley, said that nobody from the Duluth Police Department or the city collaborated with the NAACP in any way regarding the study. There was no input from our community, and yet we were named several times throughout the release of the report, which that's also a little bit of a problem there. Among other critiques of the third-party findings, LEAN wants the city of Duluth to properly respond to this data, acknowledge the faults, promise to find more appropriate contractor for the upcoming racial bias audit, for which the city recently released an RPF known as a request for proposal. So, yeah, I would make an argument. There's a little legitimate thing here that you probably don't want to go with the same group for that. Because, like I said, I mean, just on face value, really? No, there's got to be something there. I mean, I'm not buying a report just because it's, yep, nothing to see here. Really? It's a large metro area. There's biases. There are just some discriminatory practices that are just natural within police. But now, as I'm critical of this report, let me take a step back here and say, sweet Jesus, I would love to have the freaking Duluth Police Department down here in Minneapolis running things. Because once again, and we can talk a little bit about Brooklyn Center, but Minneapolis is a freaking nightmare. We don't have the problems. They don't have the problems that Minneapolis has in St. Paul, Duluth, Rochester. Not saying they don't have problems, but nothing of the cataclysmic disaster that is the Minneapolis Police Department. Bloomington, Maple Grove, Woodbury, nothing of that nature. Nope. St. Cloud, you don't hear of the systemic rot to the core that you hear with Minneapolis. And yeah, we can have a discussion about this report. We can have a discussion about whether or not that report is honest and what real problems they have in Duluth. But sweet Jesus, I would love to have that discussion as opposed to, wait a minute, did you just beat that guy in the street? Wait a second, did you just start launching crowd control munitions at residents of Minneapolis just because you wanted to? Wait a second, did you just murder a man in the street at 38th in Chicago? I'd love to have this debate about my police department. I would. Not going to disagree or discount the NAACP's concerns, but let's be honest there. Duluth doesn't seem to have nearly the problems that Minneapolis has. But yet, here we are. 952-946-6205. 952-946-6205. We might have another weird politician from the Republican side we've got to talk more about when we do return. It is the Matt McNeil Show right here on AM 950. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. It is the Matt McNeil Show. Chris Swanson, second term as the mayor of, I do believe this is, Two Harbors up on the North Shore there. Oh, cripes, yeah. Oh, gosh, the whitefish are delicious. He's in his second term. He's frustrated some residents with the overlap between his personal business and his political positions. Two Harbors city attorney Tim Costley recently returned an opinion that the mayor's online dealings, including his recently shuttered Twitter account, violate city policy and being used for his personal gain. So he's also said some, you know, kind of grandiose things which don't make a lot of sense. Well, now it's getting a little weird. A grassroots organization behind the effort to recall the mayor of Two Harbors pulled its petition on Wednesday night after several members, in addition to city officials, were named in a lawsuit by the chair of the Lake County Republican Party. Timothy Jazerinski and two anonymous residents referred to as Jane and John Doe challenged resign or recall's claim that the signatures would not be made public in a suit filed April 29th in Lake County District Court. Members of the recall initiative believed the signatures were confidential, according to the organizer Uriah Hefter, but when it was called into question, they pulled out the petition. So wait a minute here. You have two people, two anonymous residents, calling for the release of public information on a recall petition to out those names, but you're still doing this anonymously. Okay. The group still hopes that to oust Chris Swanson from his position as the mayor of Two Harbors there. Hefter said resign and recall plans to host another signature drive canvassing neighborhoods and contact those who signed the petition the first time. The group needs signatures from 20 of the city's registered voters to initiate a recall election of the North Shore town of 3,600. They delivered 970 names to City Hall last week. Well, that would be enough, wouldn't it? That'd be 20. Let's see. It's time for Matt's Math Corner. All righty. So it'd be 970 divided by 3,600. All right. One second. I screwed up. 970. Divided by 3,600, that'd be 26% of the population. So, yeah, that would be enough. Hefter is confident they can do it again. So, basically, they had enough, and then the Republican Party of Lake County sued them to out the names. I don't know why that would be a problem. I mean, if I'd sign a petition, I'm anticipating someone seeing it. Jarenzinski thought not a Two Harbors resident is a Swanson supporter. He filed the lawsuit, which also names the city of Two Harbors, the city clerk, the county city council, the interim city administrator, in addition to Todd Ronning, one of the organizers of Resign and Recall, and a handful of other members of the group. Boy, it sure seems like that might, I mean, I'm not saying it is, but kind of sounds like that might be a lawsuit to try to kill this initiative. Just try to tie him up in court. He is a self-described advocate of election integrity. I'm very happy to see that it was withdrawn. He said he wants to be the information was originally filed to make public. Once it was filed, it didn't disappear. I can't take part. You can't take and put the genie back in the bottle. A Zoom hearing in Lake County District Court calling for a temporary restraining order or for stopping action on the petition was cut short Thursday morning with the paperwork and signatures withdrawn. There is no controversy before the court, Judge Dale Harris said. There will be no government action taken on it. There's nothing to rule on this. So Swanson was not involved in this lawsuit. He was online during the remote hearing. He did not immediately return a phone call. Okay, I find this interesting. First of all, I think one of the most amazing parts of this is you filed a lawsuit to out the names of the people on the petition, but two of the people that filed the lawsuit were done anonymously. Okay. It sounds to me, and this is where I think we're getting into a real dangerous territory here. It sounds to me, and this is very much DeSantis and Disney sort of fueled thing, that if you dare speak out against us, well, you're going to become a target of our wrath, that sort of thing. That's what's going down in Florida. And there feels like there's to a point that's going on here that, okay, who exactly put their name on that petition? We want to know their names or addresses. We will find them. I mean, that kind of feels a little bit like this. Now, granted, I'll be the first to say, if you sign a petition, I think you should be anticipating that it's going to get out. Your name is going to be there. But I don't think, I mean, Two Harbors is not exactly the most conservative part of the state. I don't think it'd be too hard to imagine that a fairly large portion of the population, if they agree with the findings here, that there might be some need to possibly find a new mayor. I don't know. But needless to say, I have a feeling we're going to be talking about Two Harbors more and more over the next few months. I have a feeling indeed. Native Roots Radio, I am awake. That's coming up next. Have a good day. We are back on a Friday. Until then, see ya.